Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, January 21st, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our show, geek news, taking your calls and email, and a special story about a special computer of John Tracy's, which was recently, well, destroyed, and the story about it, which is entertaining at best. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org with your favorite web browser and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me, Miles Elam, Java programmer and developer, and student of American literature. Let me try that one once more.
Yeah, good said.
Yeah, good said. In the air room with me is geek Miles Elam, Java programmer, web developer, and student of American literature. Also looking for work right now, as I recall. And John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, also interested in getting a job at this point. So if you're interested in getting some support from
some
geeks.
We're just a bunch of desperate geeks.
You guys are. We also have very shortly Sean Cleveland, who's on his way, technical marketing communications manager for Transmeta. The geeks are here, well, to answer your calls, but not till the second half. In the first half, we're going to be doing some geek news. And to start that off, I'd like to go to Mr. Tracy. John, please, your story for this morning.
I'd like to start up with an update on last week's news about Huygens probe.
Oh, yes. Titan. Yes.
We promised a
little
bit of an update.
So it landed?
Landed.
It spoke?
It spoke. They received data. Cassini, the orbiting platform, received data from the surface of Titan from the probe for another hour and 12 minutes. But they're not exactly sure yet how long it continued to broadcast, the probe. They said that at least 3 hours after the probe landed, it was still transmitting data. They're going over the recordings from other telescopes in the Deep Space Network to see exactly how long, but it's way longer than they planned, which is great. It did manage to transmit 474 megabits of data, which is some 350 pictures and lots and lots of information from the various experiments that were
great
on board.
So has any of that been digested? Do we know anything about it?
Some has. They're doing an official broadcast on the Friday, the 21st of January.
Which is
that's today. 11 o'clock Central Eastern Time. Anyone know exactly when that is? I was going to look it up, but...
2 hours from now, or 2 hours ago, rather, I should say.
Yeah, Central and Eastern Time are two different times.
So I haven't had time to see what the press release is, but they have spent a week now gathering data and looking at it. And some of the initial things they've found are that where the probe landed, wasn't... They were expecting either A, water, or B, dirt, and they got C, which is something else.
None of the above.
It resembles wet sand or clay.
And how do they know that?
Just by the impact.
Okay.
They had a camera going, so they were able to look around and see where they were. They could see some of the ejecta that was, popped out when the craft hit. And it was muddy. Yeah. There was a thin, solid crust, most likely ice, either dirty water ice or hydrocarbon ice. The soil was a lot darker than they expected. They take an albedo measurement of the planet, which is reflected light from the planet, and it was higher. And I think that's in large part due to the clouds and low fog. They noticed a lot of what they think is fog when they were coming in, which they didn't expect. So it was pretty cool, all in all.
Sounds pretty interesting. I mean, to have a
to have a liquid state or a muddy state, this is really interesting because you don't normally get that. You get a liquid thing or you get a very hard thing, very frozen thing.
Right.
To get it in between is interesting.
And the temperature at ground level is negative 180 degrees Celsius.
That's cold.
Which is really cold. So obviously, there's not a lot of pure water.
Right.
Because water freezes.
Well, it's not water, definitely.
Zero,
yeah.
But they say it could still be a lot of debris suspended in water. You know, like a salt, like the ocean doesn't freeze when it gets really cold. Well, 180 degrees below Celsius,
frozen,
it would
yeah.
freeze.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they think it's just mixed up with a lot of other hydrocarbons.
So I'm assuming, as I've done kind of the math, that broadcast is actually happening right now. We'll have to do some more fill-in next week. I'd like to hear a little bit more about what it is and what happens, what's going on in that little moon, or actually very large.
There's a lot of information just from the little pictures that we've seen, and it's pretty amazing. So this now makes the number of places that humans have landed in other spacecraft is now 5. We've gone to the moon, we've gone to Venus, we've gone to Mars, we've gone to Titan, and there was a crash landing of the near spacecraft on the asteroid Eros. So,
and then we also have we've also been into the atmosphere of Jupiter, correct? Or Saturn? Probe a while ago did do a quote landing. You can't really land on a gas giant. Okay, well, thank you very much for the information, Miles, sir.
And speaking of Huygens, Huygens, however you want to call it.
I'll be really glad this whole story is over so we can stop mispronouncing it. Go on.
With the Saturn probe, or Titan probe, there's apparently some very sad news. After the probe landed, some folks are going to run some tests on it. However, there's one particular experiment, the experiment of a David Atkinson, who had spent 18 years on this project in preparation for it, getting it ready to go, had been tested, had been worked.
Oh, no, don't tell me his experiment failed.
Didn't fail. Rather, what happened is someone forgot to turn it on.
No.
So it got to Titan, and it's just
off,
sitting there.
Oh.
Dude, no one flipped the
on
switch.
You have our deepest sympathies, man. Oh. That's 18 years of his life spent on doing that, and someone forgot to turn it on. Oh.
That is just the worst. It's like when you're working on something and it's not working, not working, not working. You're like, oh, it's not plugged in.
Yeah, it's worse than,
it's
for example, a Mars.
Thousands and thousands of light years away.
It's worse than the Mars probe failing, because there it was just, I mean, that was a math error using feet instead of meters or
still
whatnot.
A human mistake, though.
And you come across something like this, and it's like you did nothing wrong. Someone just forgot to hit the on switch.
So they had to hit the on switch before they left Earth?
No. It was in when the Huygens probe was released. There was a whole suite.
Should we just call it the Gins?
No.
No.
The probe had 6 different instrument packages that
would
were
have to be started up.
Yeah.
And that one didn't get started up.
Apparently not. God, that bites.
Ooh, man, I'd be upset. Well, you know, maybe eventually we'll get to go back there and turn it on. I mean, a couple hundred years from now. Well,
no,
that's a shame. Thank you, Miles, for that depressing story.
You know, for this really to work, space exploration to work, you really have to remove the humans from the equation. That seems to be all there is to it.
Yeah.
So we need to build autonomous.
That's right.
Right. To take the humans out of the equation. Wait, who builds the probes again?
See? We need to automate that process.
Yeah. Okay. Go on, please, John. Next story. Thanks, Miles.
Okay, you know, I'm sorry. I have doom and gloom for my other two.
Go for it.
Let's start with
gloom.
That's
fine. I just watched iRobot again last night. So.
Speaking of artificial intelligence, go on, John.
Phishing is a common, becoming more common. Phishing is internet scams. You get an email that says, oh, your account information is out of date. Please click this link and go give us all of your juicy account information and personal information so we can steal your
Pretty
identity.
Pretty common to get these things.
Yeah.
If you ever get a message that says, your information has been lost, please go log in, it's probably false.
Yes.
Well, it's almost definitely false.
Yes. So they've been increasing over 2004. They've reached some 57 million U.S. adults and have compromised 122 well-known brands so far, you know, such as eBay and PayPal.
I get them all the time. They're kind of, they look really good. The email looks really great. I mean, it's got images, it's got text.
Right. Okay, so that's okay. You know, we're aware of that now. We don't click on them anymore. We're pretty much
one of the things we always say is, you know, if you do get one of those, you can click, don't click on the link, but go visit the site that, you know, go visit your WellsFargo.com or go visit your PayPal.com. Make sure you type in the URL correctly, and then you can log in. So what's going on?
Okay. At the end of 2004, almost half these attacks now contain some sort of spyware or other malicious code that they're downloading to your computer.
Okay.
One of the attacks first documented by the Danish security firm Sakuna misdirects web surfers by modifying the directory in the Windows machine called the host file,
mm-hmm.
which tells when you type in an entry, you know, like
yahoo.com,
like yahoo.com.
or kusp.org, for example,
right, it'll take you to a spoofed site that will look very similar to the site you're trying to get to, and will probably
specifically
prompt you to put in information.
The idea being here is that a host file, which is a common thing on Windows machine and on Unix derivative machines, you basically have a file in a special location on your system, and that file contains static mappings of IP addresses to domain names. So, for example, there's one in there on all these machines that's 127.0.0.1, and that is mapped to localhost. So when you type in the word localhost in a web browser, you will try to access your own machine. It's a loopback feature.
What happens is your browser is reading that file.
Right.
Saying, what does this
mean?
Your
system basically checks that file first before checking other things. So if you added an entry in there for kusp.org and modified the IP address to be something other than the location that Cruzio set up for KOSP's site, what would happen is you'd go to that other IP address, and the browser would be none aware, and you'd be none aware. So modifying that file is a bad thing, especially for a virus.
Right. So another thing they're doing is they're starting to put up phone books, virtual internet phone books, with matching domain names and numerical addresses. But when you click on, you know, or you visit their website, when you click on the website, it takes you to a spoofed website again.
And the thing with this thing is that the web browser URL, if they switched eBay, for example, or PayPal, if they switch it, you type in www.paypal.com, the correct URL, everything that's right. You visit a site that looks just like PayPal, it has login features and everything, and yet it's not really PayPal.
Right. So you put in your name and password, it grabs all that. There's more.
Well, let's talk about why that is a serious problem and something that is easily fixable by the user. The general idea of domain names, DNS lookups, when you type in a URL and that translates to taking you to your machine, is domain name server protocol. And that protocol is insecure. There's problems with it. It's actually quite easy. Traditionally, it's very easy to steal someone's domain name and re-register it and modify it because the way that everybody kind of has responsibility for these things. It's also easy to edit a server that would be modifying an entire network of people, and all of them would be pointed. So there is a way to get around to make sure that the domain name is correct, and that is called secure socket layers, or it's part of the secure socket layers protocol and way we do things. So when you visit a site that adds a little lock button at the bottom, and it's HTTPS,
which would be every financial site,
any login system that's going to be dealing with finances, definitely. And also the URL starts with HTTPS for S for secure.
And then also look for the little lock icon.
The little icon. I think it was on all browsers, but I don't think Safari does that.
Safari's up in the upper right-hand
corner. Most people have it down the lower left-hand corner.
And you want to make sure that lock icon looks locked.
And the HTTPS, that's the other way to look at it. Now, what will happen if you go to one of these financial sites, let's use Wells Fargo for an example, and you type in https://wellsfargo.com, if that host file is being modified and you're actually going to a different server, somebody else's, and it's a spoof, they won't have a signed certificate for that domain name. It's not possible for them to get a signed certificate for WellsFargo.com because they're not the owner of WellsFargo.com, and the certificates that get handed out, the SSL certificates, are very restricted.
Yes.
So if you get if you don't get an error when you go to a secure site, you know that you're at the right location, and that's the trick. Make sure when you log in information, anytime you put a username and password and website, you should be at https://. Very important. Some sites like webmail and things don't have that enabled by default. They have the option sometimes. You can use it if you want to be more secure, but financial systems always have that. Don't ever type in information on a non-secure site.
Yeah, on Safari you'll see the padlock up in the top right-hand corner. In Firefox, the URL bar will actually turn yellow.
Cool.
So there are visual cues to look for as well, as opposed to just the HTTPS.
And right. Of course, the malicious code that's installed is considered a worm or a virus, so keeping your antivirus updated will help prevent that from happening. And yeah, definitely checking everything else. Hey, Sean. We'll definitely checking to make sure that there is SSL is you are in a secure transaction with that website.
Crucial.
It'll keep you from giving away personal information right. Where you don't want to.
And of course, so we're talking about Windows situation. This worm and virus kind of stuff does not happen on a Mac, but on a Windows machine, make sure that you have XP, your most recent updates, including Service Pack 2.
But the DNS spoofing can still happen, because what's happening is they're hacking into
the
major businesses.
Oh.
No, not the host file. They're hacking into the major businesses' DNS servers and changing the DNS servers.
Oh, that's a different level.
That was the last part of this article I wanted to get to, is they are actually physically now, or actively
right.
going after the company's DNS. And unfortunately,
right.
most businesses run a pretty tight security, and they can detect things like that. However, they have been able to hack into certain banks in Brazil and Argentina and spoof the bank's site. Yeah.
That's bad.
So beware.
So be aware. I don't know what to do about that one, though.
It's one that they're working on.
Make sure that you have the lock enabled. And if you get an error message that says, we can't verify, you know, this browser can't verify this SSL certificate, that means it's very possible that that certificate is incorrect
right.
and wrong. And what you want to look at the details. If it's a problem, call the bank. Don't use the system. Figure out what's going on. Do not enter in your
Definitely bring it to the bank's awareness, because they are actively pursuing these
right.
kinds of people.
Okay, thank you very much, John, for that. Sean Cleveland just joined us. Sean, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning, Lyle. Where is the microphone? It's somewhere over my head.
Somewhere floating up there. I'm not going to jump to your news story right now, because you probably need a second, right?
Yes.
Yes. I'll go back to Miles. Miles, next news story from you, sir.
Fishermen off southwestern
Nova Scotia. This is real fishing, using poles, water.
Yes.
Fish.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Has caught a two-color lobster that's also hermaphrodite. It's just a really odd one. When I mean by two-color, I don't mean like one shade of brown with another shade of brown, or one shade of red with another, with a shade of brown. This is a brownish-green going down the right side of the lobster, and the other side being blue.
Blue?
Yeah, well, just to preface this for folks, one out of every 4 billion lobsters is born blue.
Yeah, I knew that.
Well, it's just
I don't want to be the guy that like counts them. Blue one. Okay, that's 1,700,000.
I think this is more of a genetic possibility rather than
just a rare thing that happens where blue.
Right, but this one is literally a line down. I mean, there's a dividing line down the middle where to the right of it you're brownish green, and to the left of it you have blue. And it's a hermaphrodite. Hermaphrodite, yeah. Meaning in traits of both sexes.
Is that rare as well, or is it common for the blue ones to be
hermaphrodites? This has never before been seen.
A hermaphrodite?
Oh, no. Hermaphroditic.
Wait, a half blue hermaphrodite's never been seen. Come on.
Well, a hermaphrodite crustacean.
Now, Miles, what is God trying to say about this?
Oh, don't get me started. However, we're on like really weird biological things, I figured I might as well just like add in some other little
things. Wait, we don't want to hear about your personal life.
No,
I'm sorry, go on.
Why do you want to go there? Why?
Miles, yes, what's the other story that's kind of
things? Odd? Well, just these are quick little tidbits, little
Please.
Bits of trivia I think people might find fun. For example, tigers have striped skin, not just striped fur.
Very cool.
So if you shave your tiger, it'll still look like a tiger.
Right, I want to know who actually did bother to shave the tiger, but yeah. The world's smallest mammal is the bumblebee bat of Thailand, weighing less than a penny.
Wow.
The Pacific giant octopus, largest octopus in the world, grows from the size of a pea to a 150-pound behemoth, potentially 30 feet across, in only 2 years, which happens to be its entire lifespan.
Wow.
They must be voraciously hungry.
And the low-frequency call of the humpback whale is the loudest noise made by a living creature. The call of the humpback whale is louder than the Concorde and can be heard from 500 miles away.
Wow.
And as the final...
In water.
Yes. And as the final little tidbit of trivia...
Wait, if the Concorde were in water, it'd be louder too.
It wouldn't be running very well.
10% of the salt mined in the world each year is used to de-ice the roads in America.
In just America?
In just America.
Are we talking about North America? Sans Canada?
Just the United States.
Just the United States. Wow. Wow. Thank you, Miles, for that story. Please go shave your tiger. And Sean, I'll go to you now, sir. No, still not ready. You look beautiful, though. John?
Thank you.
Speaking of doom and gloom.
Right, we need more of that.
Oh, this is gloom.
You know what? Let's skip it.
No, this is another thing that people need to be aware of.
All right.
But it's happening in Britain, so just don't go to Britain. You're fine. Now, it's the evil twin. Do we all know about evil twin stuff? Do we have to go?
The goatee slanted screen?
No. Evil twin sites are bogus hot spots, Wi-Fi hot spots. So you go, you sit down, you start surfing, and you're really surfing off of a stronger signal. Like, let's say you go to your favorite coffee shop, and there's someone in a car that's transmitting...
Or in a laptop in the room.
That's transmitting a really strong signal?
Sure.
Yeah, I guess enough. You could do that, yeah.
Okay.
It would have to be a signal stronger than...
The main one.
The main one. And they're spoofing that hotspot's name,
mm-hmm.
and so you log on to the hotspot like you normally do and start surfing. And they have a key logger, so it's basically recording, you know, everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But it's also recording any passwords you might happen to use, any email you might happen to transmit or receive. So, yeah.
That's great. And you know, that's going to start happening here. There's no reason that couldn't happen in the United States.
The thing I hate about this one is, what do you do against it?
Well, it's the same answer as the last story you had, actually.
No.
You make sure you use SSL websites and it'll be fine.
Because you can still go to the SSL website. It just
doesn't matter.
Oh, that's true. But the
connection is completely encrypted. And you don't use normal POP and IMAP mail. You have to use secure. Now,
the only thing they say, you know, what should you do against this? That's the obvious question. Who is this? Professor Brian Collins at Cranfield University says web users who use Wi-Fi networks should be on their guard against this type of crime.
Nice.
But
let me see if I can be more informative than that professor in England. The way you have to deal with this is you have to make sure when you're using wireless connections that you are using secure protocols on your system. And most ISPs don't support the secure protocols.
Right.
Webmail features normally, as I said, have a more secure rating. Like on Yahoo, there's a secure connection that uses SSL. SSL basically ensures that your machine and the web server are the only things that can read that data. So it doesn't matter what's in between. You always want to use those kind of protocols. Other protocols for POP would be POP-S, and IMAP would be IMAP-S, and they use normally the same port, but they use secure settings. Some ISPs support them. I highly recommend you using them.
Using the same ports? That's actually unusual.
SMTP, it's the same port.
For POP3 and for IMAP4, they actually have specific...
know off the top of your head?
Do I know the number? For POP3, I don't remember. For IMAP4, 993.
And basically, when you're using your email client, you want to go into the preferences and enable security or SSL or what other names is it called?
It might go under the name of TLS, but it's usually TLS, just under SSL.
And you click on that, and normally, automatically, your port will get modified for you, and then you try to connect, and your ISP will deny it because they don't have the service running because people don't find it that important. Really frustrating.
But then it's good to contact your ISP and get them on the ball because if you do surf wirelessly, it is really important that you encrypt your information because the wireless protocol has a lot of inherent security flaws, and data can be snapped out of the air very easily. So, in general, if you surf wirelessly and you do sensitive transactions wirelessly, definitely encrypt your stuff. If you don't encrypt your stuff, please don't do sensitive transactions wirelessly.
I'm going to wrap the news up, guys, if you're cool with that. All right.
Now that we've totally depressed everybody out there. I'll never use a computer
You know, be careful. Again. Use SSL. Try to use more security. You know, you hear it all the time.
Or just don't worry about your personal information.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet, visit geekspeak.org, and click on Contact Us.
Frank Bartocki will speak on the Bush administration agenda at 5:30 p.m. on Friday, January 21st at the United Presbyterian Church. That's at 112 East Beach Street in Watsonville. For information, call 462-0360. And I highly recommend you call because this has had a lot of crossouts in it, so I'm not exactly sure what all the information is correct. So please call 462-0360 for information.
Thank you very much for that. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are John Tracy, Sean Cleveland, and Miles Elam. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can use the internet. Visit geekspeak.org. Click on the geeks. Click on Contact Us, actually.
KUSP co-sponsors UCSC's Arts and Lectures presentation of The American Piano, featuring two internationally acclaimed pianists, Stephen Mayer and Anthony DeMar. These pianists will play pieces inspired by Scott Joplin, Jelly Roll Morton, Art Tatum, and Gershwin. The American Piano will be presented on Friday, January 21st at 8 p.m. at the UCSC Music Center Recital Hall in Santa Cruz. For more information, call 459-2159.
This is Geek Speak. We're standing by to answer your calls and questions. Phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And while we're waiting, let's talk a little bit about what you shouldn't do with a laptop computer. John, the other day, as I recall from the wonderful article you've written, which is available at geekspeak.org, you were walking around the house with your laptop wirelessly, hopefully using secure protocols.
I was within my own house. I was pretty certain I was surfing on the
right
place.
Pretty good. There's somebody parked outside.
I trust my neighbor. It's okay. Anyway, yeah. As I often do, I was walking around.
With your laptop. Your titanium laptop. The Mac PowerBook Titanium. Okay.
Right. I was going from place to place and walked by a fireplace, noticed it needed a log, set the laptop on, not the fireplace, but on the floor.
That was probably a good decision, actually.
Thank you.
Though the fireplace was another flat surface because you have a wood stove, I think that the floor would have been my first choice as well. Go on.
So I set it down, got a log, started putting it on the fire, and around came my son, daughter, dog.
Pick one of them.
Yeah, pick one.
You're not telling us which one so that the...
Johnny has walked in and pointing the finger squarely at me, and I think he's correct because I'm the guy who put the laptop on the floor in the first place.
So
whoever it was tripped, landed squarely on the laptop. The screen went flat down on the ground.
No, the laptop was open.
Laptop was open and running. So it went flat down backwards on the ground.
I'm trying to picture dog Arwen tripping. Falling on the...
I've seen that dog.
She's a puppy.
Yeah. So go on.
So the individual is fine. No damage to them. That was good. The laptop, the screen went dark on impact. And
that's a bad sign.
It was really bad. No, don't try to open yours all the way.
Now, so I actually have the aluminum, but the same thing could have happened with my machine.
I don't know if yours will lay flat or not.
No, it won't.
I don't recommend
it.
Yeah.
So basically the idea being that laptops most of the time open to a point where it's comfortable to open.
And they have these hinges, these very restrictive hinges that make it so that when you open it to a certain amount, you show off.
Sean has a very light machine that can open all the way, which is very cool.
Again, what is next?
So your dog can trip on anything he wants.
So the hinge, I looked at it, the hinge was slightly off center, and there was a wire that was poking out.
That's not good either.
Which is not good.
I mean, I'd say that the first instinct of the whole screen going black, probably a bad sign, but the wire sticking out, not good. Now this wire was severed and sticking out.
Yes.
A little loop wire sticking out, that's no big deal.
Now this is the end of the wire was poking at me.
That's never good.
In the face. So I took it upstairs, hooked it up to an external monitor, and it was still running. Everything was fine. It just, the screen was dark. So
to see pictures of this titanium cracked, you can go to geekspeak.org. John has a great little article. I would caution against using Safari on the site for some reason. There's sometimes problems. Use Firefox. If you got Safari, try it out, but your browser might crash. In any case, the pictures are great. Basically, close-ups of this really destroyed hinge.
Yeah. Other than that, the laptop's fine. The screen held up. The titanium case, I have a titanium Apple laptop, and the titanium case held the weight of the individual and kept the LCD from cracking. So the LCD screen is fine.
So it didn't get destroyed.
I can still see the image, even though there's no backlighting. And when I wake it up from sleep, there's a brief instant where the backlight comes on, and I can see everything. So everything is still working. I think the wire is probably the ground.
Yeah.
Lyle has suggested that I just run another wire to a screw on the outside of the casing and ground it that way. Yeah.
Sounds perfect.
I have no problem with
running. If the machine didn't work at all, I'd say that's the way to go. But since it kind of functions.
No.
Now, just to be clear about this titanium notebook that's destroyed and cracked like this, the first solution, of course, is just, get a new hinge. And
right.
I've been down by the hardware store, buy hinges for for like cupboard doors and stuff, and they're like $350 for a pack of two.
Sure,
so what's the problem?
Well, the hinge runs anywhere from $99 to $100. Well, $250.
That is one expensive hinge.
And it's not an easy install. Since the hinge goes very far up into the the side of the display. And that's to give it a lot of leverage so that when you're opening it and closing it repetitively, it doesn't break the hinge.
Right, so the hinge is like probably a piece of metal, probably titanium.
Right.
Again, and it's basically merged into the laptop, very built in.
Right, it goes up the side of the display an easy 4 inches.
Ooh.
So what you have to...
I've looked at titaniums. I don't see any screws on that
there are.
The panel.
There are. There's, okay. there's four small screws around the outside, and then the hinges themselves. So to get to this... first, I called around to see... Hey, you know, hinge repair is $349, $399. Will you guys guarantee it's working? I got this little wire sticking out. The first place I called said, ooh, that wire, that hooks directly into the LCD display itself. The LCD display costs about $700. We can splice it, but we have no guarantee that splice will work. So I think they're going to charge about $500. They would return my laptop with a brand new hinge, but no guarantee the backlight would work anymore.
$500 to maybe get your machine fixed.
Yeah, the hinge would work. It would close fine then, but who knows if it would actually work. So I said, well, how much is it to replace LCD screen? That whole operation would have cost around $1,400 to $1,600, depending on where I had it done.
Oh, but $1,600, you can get a brand new aluminum.
I looked it up on eBay, and you can get a used titanium on eBay. That'd be a little bit faster than that one. Or you can go up to Apple and buy a 12-inch. Laptop.
Seems like such a waste, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
well,
what
this
I did.
The machine is functional. Yeah. How are you able to? I mean, I'm assuming that all the surfing and stuff you actually did on a computer. Did you use this computer that's actually broken?
Yeah.
To do this research.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I hooked it up to an external monitor. It has a DVI port out, so I can hook it up to any monitor I have laying around. Fortunately, we had a couple of spare monitors, so it's no longer a laptop. It's now a desktop, but it's a really small desktop with a great battery backup. So,
and for the first time since you've had that laptop, you've come today to GeekSpeak without a laptop in front of you.
It's so weird.
And I feel like laughing at John. Should we all laugh at John because he has a laptop? No. What a horrible, horrible story. I'll let you finish it in just a minute. We got to take some calls.
All right. Laughing at him because that would be mean. But when Miles has a laptop that doesn't have wireless, oh, yes.
Look at the label without wireless. From Pacific Grove, and welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, you can laugh at me now, Miles. And welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, my call is about domain name theft. And what happened, I'm a citizenship teacher in Salinas, and I started a little company with two partners, and we ship citizenship materials to libraries and schools and individuals across the country and helping people who want to become citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm real proud of our materials and not making a huge profit or anything. It's, very reasonable. Anyway, so the domain name came up, and I didn't realize my two partners, how they set it up. And so I thought I was renewing through Domain Registry of America, and I should have been renewing through Redshift. Anyway, I never got a notification by mail. They notified the administrator, which was my husband. He no longer had the
email address.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I go to try to backorder it, and I tried to backorder it through Redshift, and I tried to backorder it through GoDaddy.com.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, was the domain already registered by somebody else by this point?
No, it wasn't. But somebody, while I was trying to backorder it, it got grabbed up by some guy in L.A. And so...
Have you talked to him?
I emailed him, mm-hmm. and he put the wrong phone number in his, and then he gave the right phone number. Then I tried to reach him, so I haven't really spoken directly.
Okay. Hopefully this person will be understanding and help you out. If that person is not understanding and won't help you out, then you have lost your domain. There's no legal course you can do. Now,
okay.
The process that would have worked for you is finding the register that actually was currently registered the domain and recognized your husband as the administrator, and then contacting them and saying, look, I really am that person. I used to have that email address. They would probably enter a dialogue on you, which would be talking to a person and find some level of trust with you, and then go ahead and change the administrator email to your new email, and everything would have been fine. Normally, those companies will actually have a process for dealing with that issue. What I highly recommend when registering domains, couple things. You want to have your email notification happening to two people at least. I normally use like one of my main email addresses and also like a spare Yahoo free account that I check every once in a while.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And that way, if one of those email addresses is unresponsive, then the other one will function. The other thing to do is most of these sites, when you register, will give you a username and password so you can log in and manage your stuff, and you don't have to do it all through email anymore. And that, if you keep that registration information, you can log in anytime you want and change settings. And register the domain.
Well, what I did is Redshift agreed to change the name, so I was a .com and now I'm a .org.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, and then I ended up paying $80 for the basic service for the search engines, because if I go to a search engine, I'm like not there.
Oh,
and
for
I'm
the .org?
I'm still not there. Yeah. And so do you have any recommendations about that? You think even after this I should still try to call the guy and see? I just think, you know, he's running other people's stuff there that's related to citizenship, and I have a feeling he's going to charge me some
what's the domain?
Outrageous amount.
What's the domain?
It's the name?
Yeah.
It's www.citizenadproject.com is what it was.
He might just give it to you. Who knows? I would definitely keep on trying to get in contact with him. And, you know, if he's somebody that's registering for other people and he's a clientele and stuff, you can get nasty. I mean, there's no reason not to.
Really?
It's not really going to hurt you. Sure, you can contact his clients. And this is assuming he's not just helpful right away. He's, of course, going to want some money for it because he did have to pay for it. But if you just go, can I just cover the costs and can we do this and, you know, be equitable and I'll make a mention of your site and I'll talk highly of you. And, you know, people are people. Hopefully you'll be able to talk to him and make sure he gets the point and he'll help you out. I'm hoping that will happen for you. If it doesn't, building up search engine profiles, mm-hmm. that's an interesting case. And it's probably a whole topic. but one way to do it, I mean, the ways to do it are many, but one is to make sure that the content on your page really represents what you should be searched about. And mm-hmm. that doesn't mean putting keywords in the meta information. That is useless. And it doesn't mean going to search engines and saying, I exist and this is what I represent. It means taking your pages and making sure that they clearly state the information that you want people to search about. So let's say citizenship to the U.S. or support in citizenship to the U.S. are the kind of the keywords you possibly have. Make sure you have a paragraph in there that uses those words.
Right.
Then also find a few other companies that other people that you know that have websites probably in the same genre, if you will, and ask them to add links to your site on their site. But don't have it be the link type. Make sure the text of the link is what the search phrases you like are. For example, getting citizenship to the U.S. help. Okay, you want that to be the searching link. That to be the text of the link that gets sent to you. That will help you. And then the formatting of the HTML you also want to be doing clearly. There are tags called H1 tags in HTML, and those basically are headline ones. They mean high importance. The search engine will use that H1 and rate your content higher based off of that. You normally use it for titles. So put your content, the content that you want searchable, in there. But less is more to some degree, too. I hope that helps. I hope that you get your domain back. There's, of course, no guarantee that you will.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne, from Pacific Grove. Bye-bye. All right. Clint is on Highway 101. Clint, I'm going to ask that you're not driving.
That is correct. I've actually pulled off to the side of the road.
Well, then let's take your call so you can get back to your road trip. Please, what's your question?
I actually have two comments about SSL.
Yeah.
One of them is that as part of the SSL authentication back and forth, you actually negotiate which encryption suite to use.
Mm-hmm.
What people don't realize is one of the encryption suites is the null encryption suite, which means no encryption is happening at all. You've gone through the entire SSL stuff and so forth.
Uh-huh.
The lock is on, but your data is not encrypted.
Is that the Microsoft certificate?
No, not at all. SSL in general negotiates what encryption suite to use.
And there's a null that's available on all platforms?
That is correct. It is part of SSL itself, the definition.
Well, do you still have to have a signed certificate?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, I was going to bring up that second point, which is the Microsoft Science Certificate, but you obviously know about it already.
Well, go ahead and cover it, please.
Right. Well, I just wanted to let people know that just because the lock is there on does not necessarily mean your data is encrypted. It could be in the clear.
Okay, and just to state, though, that that means that the site that got that domain registered and is the owner of that domain, like WellsFargo.com, they decided to encrypt, if you will, with no encryption.
Right.
They made that decision.
It's actually negotiated.
Right.
I bet your browser could ask for that as well. And if the domain says, sure, that's one of the suites that we support, it'll let you do it.
But it is common for web servers, especially with SSLs, to be strict about it, to enforce 128-bit encryption, for example.
Right, right.
Now, so let's assume that the WellsFargo.com people are never going to set up a certificate that does not have authentication, and it's not going to allow a browser that doesn't have encryption. Encryption.
Right.
They won't allow that. So, to some degree, at least there's that part of it. Granted, someone could do it for some reason, but I don't find a high reason for that. It seems like it would be asking for trouble. Okay, so what about the Microsoft certificate?
Right. Someone social engineered one of the top-level certificate authorities and got two certificates with Microsoft's name on them issued to them.
Right, but they've been yanked, right?
No, they haven't. Well, they may have been yanked, but let's face it, the whole security infrastructure does not really enforce looking to see if certificates have been yanked.
Right.
The only news that I have is that apparently it has not yet surfaced yet. They have not actually seen it in the wild.
Right. And hopefully Microsoft is being smart enough that when they release patches to their browser, at least they yank it. Because at least they can do that with their software package, make sure that the SSL encryption package as part of the browser is safe, if you will. Now,
well,
is
one
upgraded.
Would hope.
Yeah, well, one would hope, but who knows? Okay, so this is a really serious issue, and this could happen to anybody. It's very similar to our last call, Anne in Pacific Grove, who was talking about her domain got stolen. Not really stolen. She didn't register it in time, and someone else registered it. But in any case, let's say someone were able to say, I'm Microsoft.com, and I want a SSL certificate, and the signed authoritative body, who is kind of hard-coded, if you will, inside of your browser. It's more complicated than that, but in general, there's a body that says I like your certificate and I will sign your certificate, which means I take responsibility that you are who you say you are in that certificate. Somebody basically went to one of those companies, they're called certificate authorities, and was able to trick them into issuing them a certificate for a Microsoft domain. And that basically means that someone can make a spoof Microsoft.com site and have SSL enabled, and it's not really Microsoft.com. And it's a serious issue. And it's a hole, basically, it's a social engineering thing, which means that a person decided to make that call. Not a great thing. It is an issue. I wouldn't say that it's something you should worry about that much. Would you agree with that, Clint?
I typically try not to go to a Microsoft website anyway.
It's really an issue, though, because, of course, whenever we talk about security threats and problems and stuff, we say, go to windows.microsoft.com, right?
Always trust
Windows
Microsoft.
Update. Right, and you've got to accept their signed certificates, and you've got to do all these things to get the software packages that make your machine more safe. In reality, that whole thing could be falsified.
Right. I have one other comment about the British attack that's happening. It's the first I'd heard of it, but it's quite easy to do.
Yeah.
I know that a lot of people who are in the Wi-Fi area, or 802.11, as you will, are trying to figure out how to do mutual authentication of the access points.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, most of the time when they do authentication, they're making sure you are who you are.
Right, right.
But at no point are they really thinking that it's necessary for you to determine that who you're talking to is correct.
Right.
If you're going to start seeing attacks like this, that's going to become more important in the future.
And the other thing to be really important, and I think this is probably the best way to go about it, is that except that Ethernet in general, or TCP/IP protocol in general, is not secure enough. So it's not meant to be. So what you need to do is make sure that when you're transferring data, that you are assured of your security at that level. And that's why SSL, for example, is so important.
Right. You can click on the lock, and it'll tell you what kind of encryption they're using, by the way.
That's a good idea. Taking a look at that's a good idea. Clint, thank you for the very informative call. I hope you have a good trip on Highway 1.
Well, I'm actually on 101 right now.
Oh, 101, excuse me. Yes. Take
care. I said I was on one before, but yes.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I love it when we get a geek that just knows his stuff, calls in, tells us what's going on.
I'm still trying to disseminate all of that.
Well, I got it all, so don't worry about it.
Thank you.
It's all about whether I understood it. From Redwood City, Ras. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, geeks. How you doing now?
Quite well. Thank you for calling. What's your question?
Well, yeah, this isn't a big-time geek, so I'm going to... That's why I'm calling. My ISP is SBC, and what I discovered recently was that they changed the they blocked the port on, not mine, but, you know, many people to not deliver email. I can get email, but I can't send it because they blocked the port. That's, you know, for two or three days, I couldn't figure out why my email wasn't sending. I even got a new program, did everything, and then got on some webmail thing, see if it worked there, and it did. So from my...
I don't know the story specifically about this, but what it sounds like is a machine at your IP address, your MAC address, on their network was spamming, was sending out a lot of mail. And they detected that and decided that they would no longer accept email being sent from your machine.
No, not necessarily.
That's a good reason for them to do it. And that's one reason.
Well, they're doing it to everybody. So, you know, this is part question, part warning. Everybody has SBC as their DSL service.
Wait a second. There's no reason for SBC not to grant you being able to send email. So I don't understand why they would do that.
Well, they did it.
Can
and
you
they,
tell me?
I verified it yesterday, and they said, yes, we blocked the port. And I said, well, why? Well, you know, we're trying to, you know, they had all I'm talking to somebody in India, so what do they know?
Right, Chris.
Well, they, basically, I went on to, there's this site called Broadband Reports. You probably heard of it. And so I got on some of the forums, and yes, indeed, they're doing it globally to everything.
Okay.
Let's
be clear
down.
About this. They are an ISP. They provide email service to people. They are not going to stop providing email service to people. There's no reason for them to do that. So the question I have for you is, were you using an SMTP server that was not SBC's? Were you using someone else's SMTP server?
In other words, yeah, I want to send mail from a domain that I've had now for 10 years.
Okay, so it's a confusion issue that the techs of people on SBC are not handling correctly.
No, because they just did it, and I couldn't figure out why.
Sean's looked this up, so let's go ahead and talk to him about it.
Well, I have SBC service, and I just checked my email at sbc.prodigy.net. You can do it through a browser that way. I still have mail, and this morning my SMTP still works.
Okay, well, the issue was being able to send mail so that he will have his email coming from a domain other than SBC, so he won't have an email address that has SBC.
I can get the mail. I got the mail. It didn't stop it from coming in.
Right.
I can't send it.
Okay.
That's what I was saying. This morning I sent email from my own domain through SBC's SMTP, and it worked.
Ras, thank you very much for the call. We're going to go ahead and keep on answering this, but we're going to take you offline.
Yeah.
Miles, tell us a little bit about the difference between receiving email. Describe what's going on.
The issue at work here is that SBC, I personally have had some issues with SBC in the past. At the same time, in this case, they're in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, where if you have, they're blocking port 25, which is send mail, SMTP. And the reason for this is because compromised computers, zombie PCs, things that have had viruses affect them, whatnot, will send email, and the way they send email is through port 25, send it out. And they will make direct connections to the outside world to a variety of different servers to be able to try to infect more systems. And
that's bad. That's like 80% of the spam out there is happening because of rogue machines, individuals' machines sending spam.
Right. That, and you have folks who are setting up mail servers or are trying to do it legitimately, but don't have the technical training to be able to do it. And so either or you have someone who's trying to set up their own, you know, networking service just on a DSL line, which is sucking up a huge amount of bandwidth.
So there's reasons for them to do it. Now let's talk about what is really happening. Basically, they have servers in place for everybody connected to their network that are SMTP servers. They're probably smtp.sbcglobal.com or something to that effect. You have that probably information in your startup package when you got the information from them. You could probably look it up online pretty quick what their SMTP servers are. Those SMTP servers will receive mail from their network and send it to anyone you want. They will do that for you for free, no problem. And the path will be through them. But the reply address and the from address do not have to be – the reply to address and the from address do not have to be SBC Global email address. It can be anything you want. So the trick is you set up your profile and your email client to be – like, for example, I'm My email address is lyle@troxel.com, my personal one, right? And that my carrier, the people that I get service from, is actually Comcast. When I'm at my home, if I want to send email out from my address, I have to tell Comcast to send it. I have to contact Comcast's SMTP server to send the message. But when people receive it, unless they look into the headers and such, they wouldn't know that. It just, if they reply to it, it goes back to my lyle@troxel, if they, and so on. So it's okay for that to occur. And it's really about this having to be able to trust that when you have an SMTP server that sends email, the server has to have restrictions on it, because if it can allow email called relaying to anybody in the world from outside, then a spammer will send that's not even an SMTP customer. They will set up a system where they just tell us the SBC's SMTP server, the mail server, to send spam for them. And SMTP, if it had that feature enabled, would just keep on sending spam all day long, and that would be very bad. And it's bad because it's hard to stop it. So what they do instead is the SMTP servers, the email sending servers, restrict the ability to receive a message. They say, I'll receive a message for any of my customers, any of my SBC email addresses, and I'll also receive any email message for people inside my network. Okay, all is great and dandy. That's how it's been going on for years. Everybody does this. So if you're at home, you have to use SMTP. You don't have to use them. You could find some other SMTP server and send it to them if they accept it. And so what happens is if SBC keeps that port open, there'll be a machine at home that has a virus on it. And that virus will say, I want to send email to these 4,000 email addresses. And it will contact each of the mail servers that's responsible for that email address and say, please accept this message. It acts as its own server. And that is causing a massive amount of spam to happen. So what SBC decided to do is, you know what? If you're in our network, we're just going to turn off this port 25 completely. You have to use our SMTP service. That way, if your IP address is spitting out all these messages, we know that you're infected and we can deal with it. If we don't do that, the traffic's just shooting all over the place and we're not having control of it. So they decided you can no longer use anybody else's SMTP service. You have to use ours. If they had a good program and tell people how to do that effectively, this wouldn't be a problem at all. But instead, they did it without informing people. And that's the problem at hand. Did I explain that so that anyone understood it?
Yes, and as a final note,
yes.
If you are an ISP and you are having a whole bunch of spam being sent from you, a lot of other ISPs on the net will block your IP segment so that you cannot send any traffic, any email back and forth. It's a self-defense mechanism as
well. Right. And it's called blacklisting, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty common thing that happens as well. And so what's going to happen, of course, is all these IP addresses inside of SBC's network are going to get blocked all the time because they're spamming. And it becomes kind of a cluttering issue.
This makes it very difficult for notebook owners as well. Because if you're traveling
that's
between wireless networks, you can't send mail.
So the solution, and this is the greatest thing about all this, here's the solution. You don't send insecure email message, you encrypt them, you encode them. I'm hoping that SBC allows this service, but basically it means I want to use this SMTP server, and I want all my traffic to that thing to be authenticated, meaning I have to log in, and I want it to be encrypted, meaning no one else can look at the message. And now I use one SMTP server all the time, no matter where I am. The problem is SMTP always works on port 25. So if SBC closes that port and I go to an SBC connection, I can't send the mail that I normally send through my work, UCSC, which allows encryption stuff. I can't send it to them because SBC will block it. And that's a fatal flaw in the design that they decided to do. I'm assuming they'll repeal it, but I see why they decided to do it.
So if you know a spammer, I'm not actually saying, not advocating violence, but if you happen to have a bat and know where their car is.
Or their computer. Servers.
Right. One question, one more call from Ron. Ron from Santa Cruz, what's your question?
Hello.
Hi.
I really am enjoying your program a lot.
Thank you.
And I have kind of a simple question. I use Mac, and I want to run some Windows software, and wondered two questions. What you recommended, is there anything that will really do that efficiently?
And your second question?
And the second is, would that affect the virus susceptibility on the Mac?
Okay, thank you for the call. We'll
I
answer
can answer this. No Mac will run your PC software more efficiently than a PC.
Right. Second part of that, John, yes, there is Windows software, correct, on a Mac?
There's two different variations. One is an open source. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head.
The other one?
Go up to OpenOSX. org. The other one is Virtual PC by Kinectix, which is the kind of de facto standard. And as for viruses,
we can't get into that because we're out of time. Unfortunately, you can send us an email if you'd like. The geeks are always available at geekspeak.org. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning, John Tracy, Miles Elam, and Sean Cleveland. Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz.
This week on This American Life,
we knew.
Into the toilet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We knew. What it's like to do vaudeville and nightclubs and spend years and finally get a break and get onto the Ed Sullivan Show. And not just any Ed Sullivan. Ed Sullivan at the height of his power. All America is watching, and you bomb.
Not only didn't he call us back on stage, he didn't call us back.
Period.
From Public Radio International, This Week.
Hear This American Life Sunday morning at 10 on KUSP.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Otto, on the web at kusp.org. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. Thanks for listening.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission is planning to step down. Michael Powell will leave in March. NPR's Netta Ulaby has more.
Michael Powell has led...